Today on Against the Grain, the effects of global warming are, as we know, not just waiting for us in the future, but here already in the form of droughts, superstorms, fire, and other types of extreme weather. Yet politicians have done little over the last 25 years to halt climate change. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll speak with Dale Jamieson about how and why attempts to stop global warming failed or weren't even tried. That's coming right up. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The beginning of the collapse of much of the West Antarctic ice sheet earlier this year was a horrifying symbol of the failure to stop serious climate change. It potentially sets in motion a 10-foot rise in sea levels over the next several hundred years. U.S. politicians have known about global warming at least since Lyndon Johnson, but whether Democrat or Republican, have failed to take meaningful action to halt it. In fact, the Clinton-Gore administration, much ballyhooed for the vice president's high-profile stance on climate change, expressly chose unfettered economic growth over reining in greenhouse gas emissions. My guest today calls the 1990s a lost decade. Dale Jamieson teaches environmental studies, philosophy, and law at New York University. He's written a book called Reason in a Dark Time: Why the Struggle Against Climate Change Failed, and What It Means for Our Future. That's published by Oxford University Press. A philosopher by training, he was formerly affiliated with the National Center for Atmospheric Research, where much of the early study of global warming took place. Dale Jamieson, you've followed this issue for 25 years. How did you get involved in it?
Well, the story is quite a personal story. I came to the University of Colorado as a young academic to take a teaching position, and I got a telephone call from the chair of the department who said, well, the good news is you got the job. The bad news is you have to teach a course in something called environmental ethics with an environmental scientist named Mickey Glantz. And at that time, there were hardly any courses in environmental ethics, and of course, I didn't have any idea who this Mickey Glantz guy was, who was a scientist at the National Center for Atmospheric Research. And so the bad news was for the students. I think the course was kind of a disaster. But the good news is that Mickey and I became friends. And so it was really through Mickey that I got involved at the National Center for Atmospheric Research and got involved with this problem. And the story kind of brings out two things that I think are interesting. One is when it comes to these funny problems that don't belong to any particular discipline or area, not popular problems, often I think the kinds of connections and collaborations that need to get made are really very personal ones. But secondly, at that time, this was kind of almost an intellectual curiosity, the problem of climate change. I mean, it looked like, well, if we keep injecting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, it looks like we're going to get a warming, but surely there must be some feedback that's going to cancel this warming. It's just a question of when it will be discovered. And if there's no feedback, then certainly the adults in Washington, the policymakers, will take care of this problem because we've got a pretty long time horizon here. So I started off really sort of on the kind of intellectually interested, skeptical end about whether this was a serious problem. And then through the years, I just became increasingly alarmed that it was clearly a serious problem and we weren't addressing it.
And what role did a philosopher have to play in all of this in the National Center for Atmospheric Research?
Well, I think it really started as a kind of philosophy of science or sort of epistemology contribution. Climate science is a funny kind of science, and I think that's part of the problem it has in getting traction. Most of us, if we take a course in chemistry or physics in high school or college, the first chapter of the textbook will say something like, you know, what we go out and do in the world is we make these observations, then we try to develop a theory to explain those observations, make some predictions. If the predictions don't come true, then the theory's false, we need a better theory, and so on. So we tend to think of science as really being, in this way, very empirical, and the theories being quite falsifiable by one observation. But climate science is largely conducted on supercomputers. And a lot of what goes on in climate science is really trying to reconstruct the past and then dealing with new forcings that come into the climate system and seeing what kinds of consequences they'll have for the future. So even within the scientific community and broadly the intellectual community, there was a great deal of suspicion about this way of doing science back in the 1970s and 80s. So those were really the first set of questions that I was interested in thinking about, was the status of this as a science. But then it became increasingly clear that if climate change were to happen, that it was going to have really important distributional impacts. It was going to affect future people more than present people, poor people more than rich people, people who live in the higher latitudes more than people who live in the lower latitudes. So questions about ethics and politics then began to get really central to my thinking. And even before that, again, I owe this to Mickey Glantz, who's one of the people to whom my book is dedicated, that even Mickey had been working for years on how it is that we're not very well adapted to climate variability. So if you think just about Hurricane Katrina, for example, Hurricane Katrina is important because it is a kind of signal of climate change. But even if climate change weren't in the equation, even if it were just climate variability, the sort of normal thing that the climate system turns up every once in a while, it still is a hugely catastrophic event for poor communities and communities of color. And so climate variability, even without climate change, is one of those secret vulnerabilities that's been there for a long time.
Well, you've started to touch on this already, but one of the things that your book does is it traces the development of climate science, looking at how the problem has been understood over time. When can we date the beginning of climate science to?
Well, climate science itself really goes back to the early 19th century. When we got this idea originally of the greenhouse effect from the French mathematician and philosopher Fourier. But there was a consistent tradition of studying climate change throughout the 19th century that was mostly connected to people trying to understand the ice ages. In the 19th century, it was really kind of shocking to people, especially against the background of sort of creationist theological beliefs, that the Earth had actually been through these radically different epochs. And so there was a great deal of interest in trying to understand what drove those. There was one school of thought that thought it was driven essentially by the physics of the planet, by the Earth's orbit and the tilt of the planet. And there was another school of thought that chemistry, atmospheric chemistry, mattered. And so there was a kind of argument or dispute between those two ways of looking at things that drove a lot of the research in the 19th century.
And then what about in the 20th century? How did climate science evolve?
So one thing that's extremely interesting is that Svante Arrhenius, who was a Nobel Prize-winning Swedish chemist, by 1903 basically made predictions about what the consequences would be of a doubling of atmospheric carbon dioxide that are very much within the range of what we're predicting today. Now, interestingly, Arrhenius had the right result, but there was a lot that he didn't know. And in particular, he didn't know that water vapor is a very important absorbent of heat in the atmosphere. So what happened after Arrhenius published these calculations is that once people discovered the importance of water vapor, they thought that Arrhenius's results must be wrong. But what actually brought Arrhenius back was the discovery of new ways of understanding the spectrum, new ways of understanding where different parts of the radiative spectrum are absorbed in the atmosphere. And that research really came out of wartime work in World War II. So when we got to the end of World War II and people began to see that there were actually parts of the spectrum where carbon dioxide could absorb, where water vapor couldn't, that people began then to start thinking about CO2 as an important greenhouse gas. So in the 1950s, we were getting articles in Scientific American and National Geographic, the kind of popular science press, that was talking about CO2 and the possibility of an enhanced greenhouse effect and a warming that would result from using fossil fuels.
Which will certainly surprise a lot of listeners, I imagine, who would guess that any discussion of climate science is fairly new. So after this period, then, what happened in the 1970s in scientists trying to get a handle on the data that was starting to come in about climate change?
Well, I think before we get to the 70s, it should be mentioned that actually in 1965, the issue landed on the desk of President Lyndon Johnson, and there's a reference to climate change being driven by the emissions of fossil fuels in a presidential message. And even during the Nixon administration, there's a series of two memos that were written by Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who became famous later as a United States senator and is the author of the Nine Neglect memo on race. But Moynihan wrote a memo to John Ehrlichman, Nixon's domestic policy advisor, basically laying out the science beautifully in two pages and talking about sea level rise. And he even uses the phrase that that in another century it might be goodbye New York, goodbye Washington. So, you know, these possibilities were well understood. What happens in the 1970s, you know, part of the story is about the rise of supercomputers, which allowed scientists to do modeling that they hadn't been able to do before. It had been back-of-the-envelope calculations before then. But also, in general, for reasons that I think have to be understood to some extent sociologically, there's just a lot more interest in non-equilibrium systems, systems that change. We began to see the world, maybe in part as a result of the events of the 60s, as being subject to change and to shock in a way that we hadn't before. So there began to be a lot of research in climate science, looking at the possibility of climate change, both on the cooling side and on the warming side, but also in ecology as well. People became interested in what happens if ecological systems are shocked in various ways. So the science really began to take off in the 1970s and 80s. Then.
So at what point was there really a consensus amongst scientists that human-created climate change was real and serious?
So, consensus is a funny word because, of course, one can always find outliers. But I think one thing that's not very well appreciated goes around the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And essentially, what happened is that by the mid to late 1980s, people who worked in this field were starting to get alarmed. And people were, scientists, atmospheric scientists, were flying around the world, and scientific conferences were issuing statements, really manifestos, saying, we have a serious problem, we have to cut emissions. And this was rather annoying to the governments of the world. Remember, the Reagan administration was in power then. They didn't really like these scientists just flying around the world and making political statements, especially on foreign soil, especially in collaboration with scientists from other countries. So the Reagan administration agreed, along with some international agencies, to create this thing called the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And there's two things that are really important about this. First is that it's almost unprecedented in history to try to bring the scientists of the world together to make consensus statements about what we know about any particular problem. Second thing that's important about this is it's not an international panel on climate change. It's an intergovernmental panel on climate change. So this is an organization. It's often talked about in the popular press as UN science or something like that, but it's actually science that's, or the statements are actually approved by all the governments who are parties to the IPCC. And in 1990, which was the first IPCC report, that's really when we get the first statement of a consensus that we're getting a buildup of greenhouse gases and we're likely to get a warming. So I think it's reasonable to date the consensus from 1990. And, of course, that's been what led to the adoption of the Framework Convention on Climate Change in 1992 at the Rio Earth Summit.
Dale Jamieson is my guest. He's the author of Reason in a Dark Time. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, and my name is Sasha Lilly. So In the early 1990s, in 1992, in fact, there was a gathering which in many ways serves as the time marker for the beginning of an era around the politics of climate change. And that was the Rio Earth Summit. Tell us what that was. And of course, it had a governmental component and a non-governmental component to it.
Right. So the first thing I think to understand about the Rio Earth Summit is the context in which this was occurring. This was occurring at a time in which there was enormous enthusiasm around the world that we were at a turning point, that since the end of World War II, the world had been divided between the East and the West, between the competing systems of capitalism and communism, issues about the underdevelopment of the South, issues about the global environment. Everything had been subordinated to the Cold War. But when we began to see the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe, and we have to remember that throughout the 70s and 80s, there were a series of international reports that were led by people like Willy Brandt and Olaf Palme, who were highlighting the North-South inequities. All of these things were coming together, and many people were beginning to see an opening for reorienting our concern away from this East-West capitalism-communism dynamic to a North-South dynamic, a kind of cooperative dynamic in which we could both protect the global environment, much of which we wanted to protect were in the countries of the South, while at the same time contributing to the development, the human development, and increase in standard of living in the poor countries in the South. And so the Rio Earth Summit, the technical name of the Rio Earth Summit, is the United Nations Conference on Environment and Development. And it was really meant to forward both of those things. So that's the first important piece of this, is the twin focus on environment and development is going together. The second important focus was that this was really the first of these UN conferences to really mobilize, and I would even say create, global NGOs who went and lobbied for these treaties and tried to influence opinion leaders.
And by NGO, you mean non-governmental organizations.
That's right, exactly. So we can really date the creation of the global environmental movement from 1992, because what happened is you would get American and European environmentalists showing up in Rio, and they were meeting environmentalists from the South and indeed environmentalists from other countries of the North. And people were recognizing how much they had in common, but also how much they had to learn from each other. And that's really the birth of this global cooperation among environmentalists. So one of the things that came out of the Rio Earth Summit were a set of treaties and the negotiations. But another thing that came out was this global citizens movement, which once it was out, no one has ever been able to put it back in the box.
So tell us about the former part of what you've just mentioned, the policy framework that was set up during the Rio Earth Summit. What was it?
So essentially what happened with the Framework Convention on Climate Change is that virtually every country in the world agreed to a treaty and ratified a treaty that said that the objective of the treaty was to prevent the dangerous anthropogenic warming of the Earth's atmosphere. Now, there were no mandatory emissions restrictions that were written into that treaty. The Europeans supported mandatory emissions restrictions. The United States opposed them, along with some other countries. So instead, what we have in the treaty itself is some fairly ambiguous language, but language that strongly implies that countries, the rich industrialized countries, will bring their emissions back to 1990 levels by the year 2000 using voluntary means.
Which obviously did not happen. You've kind of alluded to it already when you were mentioning the Reagan years. Clearly, one essential thread in this whole story has been the role of the United States. You mentioned how in the 1960s, Lyndon Johnson, Nixon, and the 70s were aware of the problem of climate change. How would you characterize the role of the United States from that time to now. Obviously, there are many different episodes and different administrations and forms, but how would you generally characterize the policy coming out of this obviously most crucial country?
Well, the United States has really been the primary obstructionist to international action on climate change. And in a general way, that thread runs through all American administrations, whether Republican or Democrat. And in fact, you know, it's sometimes argued that Republicans use the religious right during election years, but then once they're in power, actually tend to forward policies that have much more to do with economics, with free market economics, and they tend to forget the social issues. Something like that, can be said about Democrats, that issues like climate change and global environmental quality get used during election years, but then when it comes to governing, there isn't all that much difference between the Democrats and the Republicans in practice. There hasn't been until recently, anyway. There is, in terms of rhetoric, but I think what that suggests is that the problem of climate change is such a difficult problem, such a structural problem, that it's very difficult for our political system to really get its arms around this problem.
So what role did the United States play then in the Earth Summit? And perhaps you could say something about subsequent summits that have taken place under the auspices of the United Nations and the importance of those in shaping policy, or to the degree that they weren't effective in doing so, around global warming.
So there's a kind of story that I try to tell in my book, beginning from the Rio Earth Summit in 1992, that ends with the Copenhagen climate meeting in 2009. And essentially what happens in 1992 is that there's such a global consensus that it's time to act on questions of environment and development that it's extremely hard, even for a Republican administration led by George Herbert Walker Bush, to resist. There were elements in the Bush administration that just didn't want the president to go to Rio, but there was simply no way that he could refuse to go. The pressures were that enormous. Now, during the election campaign of 1992, you will remember that Albert Gore had just published this book called Earth in the Balance, and so even though Bush had advertised himself as the environmental president, even though he'd gone to Rio and had agreed to the Framework Convention on Climate Change, though not to some other treaties that were negotiated there, he was clobbered in the election campaign for not being as vigorous an environmentalist as the Clinton-Gore ticket was. But then what happened is that once the Democrats came into power, there was an attempt to do some climate policy around a tax that President Clinton sent to Congress, a tax on essentially British thermal units, the amount of heat that fossil fuels generate. But, you know, like a lot of the Clinton policies, it was a bit too clever by half, that rather than dealing with the climate change issue and emissions directly, it was an attempt to get there in a somewhat indirect way. That law essentially failed. It just turned into a very small gasoline tax, a revenue-raising gasoline tax, and then essentially the Clinton-Gore administration walked away from the climate change issue and just celebrated economic growth, which brought with it extremely large increases in emissions. Now, meanwhile, what was happening internationally is people saw that while some European countries were actually returning to 1990 levels of emissions, the spike in U.S. emissions just kept going up. So there was a meeting in Berlin in 1995, in which all the countries, including the United States, agreed that by the end of 1997, there would be mandatory limits on greenhouse gas emissions without imposing new restrictions on developing countries. So the U.S. agreed to that in 1995, but then when we got to Kyoto,
and this is 1997.
In 1997, the politics were very difficult for the Americans, because they were under enormous and growing pressure from the right not to agree to emissions restrictions without developing countries agreeing to something. And, of course, developing countries weren't going to agree because they were largely, at that point, not responsible for the greenhouse gases that were in the atmosphere. So it looked like the Kyoto negotiation might just fall apart, but that was going to be disastrous for the Democrats because, after all, they were supposed to be the environmentalists. So at the last minute, Clinton sent Gore to Kyoto to sort of agree to anything to make sure there was a treaty. And so what we got was a very badly worded treaty, lots of loopholes, countries having very different understandings, and a treaty that Clinton had no intention of sending to the Senate for ratification because it was going to be dead on arrival.
And since then, so you mentioned that the kind of period of, I don't know if pretense is the word that you would choose to use, but a political effort to rein in climate change, one can date from the Rio Earth Summit in 1992 to the Copenhagen Conference in 2009. And of course, we're talking more than a decade after Kyoto, but remind us what happened in that decade and why things fell apart so badly in Copenhagen.
So essentially, to round off the story of the 1990s, it was a lost decade. That was a decade in which the United States should have started moving towards a green economy. But meanwhile, emissions were just continuing to rise. And then in 2000, the Bush administration came into office. And there were a lot of oddities about this because during the election campaign, Bush actually said that he was going to regulate carbon dioxide as a pollutant under the Clean Air Act, which is the policy that the Obama administration has now adopted. But Gore wouldn't agree to do that. So during the campaign, Bush was actually on the green side of Gore on regulating carbon dioxide under the Clean Air Act. Then as soon as the election was over and Bush took office, he renounced that policy. And then a couple of months later, he renounced the American signature on the Kyoto Protocol altogether. So during the Bush years, there was kind of a wobble between climate change denial and climate change inaction. It was just sort of an issue that they wished would go away. But in terms of emissions and the growth of emissions, there really wasn't a lot of difference between the Bush years and what had gone on during the Clinton years. The rhetoric was different, but in both of these administrations, the issue was not really being taken seriously as a policy priority. Then when Obama comes in, there's two important things going on with the new Obama administration. Three, really. One is he assembles a kind of climate change green team. Climate change dream team. So he makes very strong appointments of people who understand the issue very well and are very committed to it. And the president is committed to it, to the issue as well. But then two things happen. One is he decides to prioritize the Affordable Care Act instead of some policy that would put a price on carbon. And by the time the Affordable Care Act gets passed, he has no political capital left, really, to attack climate change through legislation. And the second thing that he does, which I think is arguably the correct thing to do, but is kind of typical, I think, of the president's caution, is he's not going to make the same mistake that the Clinton-Gore administration made in Kyoto. That is, he's not going to agree to anything in Copenhagen that he can't actually implement at home. And since there's very little that he can implement at home, that means he doesn't have much to put on the table at Copenhagen. So the American offer at Copenhagen turns out to be very weak, and all then that really can come out of the Copenhagen meeting is a kind of voluntary agreement called the Copenhagen Accord, which essentially says that various countries, including developing countries, are going to stand up and voluntarily agree to reduce emissions by a certain level, and then those commitments will be reviewed at various points in the future. So it was a complete abandonment of the idea of mandatory emissions restrictions. So that was really, from my point of view, the end of the process, because we went into Rio with the presumption that we were going to get mandatory emissions limits and we were going to move the world away from a fossil fuel-driven economy. By the time we got to Copenhagen, we had backtracked after emitting vastly more fossil fuel and sending diplomats all around the world talking and negotiating. We had even backtracked from the very commitment to mandatory emissions reduction. So that was the end of the story as far as I was concerned. The international attempt to control greenhouse gas emissions at that point was RIP, dead, over, finished.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, found online at kpfa.org. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with the author of Reason in a Dark Time, Why the Struggle Against Climate Change Failed and What It Means for Our Future. His name is Dale Jamieson, and he was formerly affiliated with the National Center for Atmospheric Research, philosopher by training. His books include Ethics and the Environment. So I want to ask you about the larger recognition that the struggle, as you put it in the title of the book, against climate change has collapsed. But before I do that, where do things stand now with the Obama administration in terms of its policies around slowing down climate change, and how politically viable do you see them to be?
So the first thing to say is that globally, the struggle to slow down climate change and to adapt to it is now a struggle that's happening at the national level, at the subnational level, at the regional level, and so on. So it's happening in every country in the world. That's where the action is. It's just not at the global level anymore. And in the United States, particularly this second term Obama administration, I think has done a stellar job of trying to address this issue, given the weak and in many ways quite inappropriate tools that are really available to them to address the issue. So, for example, the president has increased CAFE standards on cars, that is the miles per gallon requirements on automobile fleets. That has the effect of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. There's been this move to replace coal with natural gas. Natural gas has its own issues, including controversial issues around fracking and so on.
Sure, methane releases.
Yes, that's right. But in terms of greenhouse gas emissions, it helps to suppress emissions. And then these regulations on coal-fired electrical generating plants that have been announced are extremely important in terms of getting these high-polluting electrical plants out of action. Now, I think the political rollout has been brilliant. He's done it as well as you can hope to do it. I'm hopeful that these regulations will stay in place. But, of course, it does depend to some extent on court decisions and on election results. But I do think that he's been as effective as it's possible to be, given his legal authority, in this last year.
And what about the Keystone XL pipeline, which would bring tar sands from Canada to the U.S.?
Yeah, so from my perspective, that is not the deal breaker that many environmentalists hold it out to be. It's certainly not a good thing to do, but I think the focus on coal is more important than the focus on oil, even unconventional oil. And I think there's other decisions. For example, there's a case now about whether the American Export-Import Bank can actually fund the development of coal mines and coal-powered power plants offshore. The Obama administration wants to prevent them from doing it. The political opposition in Congress wants to allow them to do it. Those kinds of things are in their own way, I think, just as important, but they don't have the same kind of symbolic value as the pipeline case. So from my own perspective, and indeed this is a theme that runs through the book, I think we need generally to back away from the kind of all-or-nothing, highly symbolic politics that have infected this issue and start looking at this issue in a much more clear-minded and analytical way. And in particular, I think we need to look at the whole portfolio, the whole spectrum of possibilities, and not just focus on a single policy as if that's the one that makes all the difference.
Sure, but what about the question of limiting coal production in the U.S., but then shipping that coal elsewhere so that although it doesn't immediately impact the air here, in terms of global warming, the overall effect is the same?
Yeah, that would be true in the case of coal mining, but that's not really much going to happen. The American domestic coal industry, even without climate considerations, is really on its way out. Shale oil production, yes, we're going to see these somewhat unconventional ways of producing oil that are going to happen. Much of this will go into the global marketplace, but here's one way of looking at this. There's no doubt that we're going to burn all of the easily economically recoverable oil in the world. There's some question about where we'll stop. So shale oil production is a kind of oil production where we shouldn't go, and we should stop as soon as we can stop. But it's clear that the world is going to produce some oil in relatively unconventional ways. That's expensive oil to produce that will go into the global market. And part of the reason for that is because oil has some very positive properties. It's highly transportable, for example, can run in automobiles and so on. Coal, on the other hand, if we were to use all of the easily economically recoverable coal that we have in the Earth's surface, that would be unbelievably devastating. That would cause a climate catastrophe that's almost beyond imagination. So that's why I think the focus really needs primarily to be on coal. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm in favor of shale oil production. I'm not, or that I'm in favor of the XL pipeline. I'm not. But there's a certain amount of political capital, I think, that environmentalists have, and I think it's important to expend it in the most effective way.
Let me ask you about how the general public sees these questions relating to climate. Clearly, there is a great deal of misinformation that has been produced by what have been often called merchants of doubt, those often funded by the oil industry or coal industry to shed doubt on the scientific consensus, if we can call it that, about global warming, which seems pretty clearly established. But even for those who believe that global warming is real and human-created, there hasn't been the kind of political push from below around climate that perhaps one might hope for, given how serious the problem is. How do you understand that?
I think, you know, a friend of mine, Cameron Hepburn, once said that if you wanted to design a pill that would put an end to the human race, it would produce many of the perceptual and sensory characteristics of climate change. And I think that's true. I mean, you know, it's easy to find fault with people, political actors who haven't acted on climate change, and corporations who've really behaved in ways that are just thuggish and immoral. But at the same time, I mean, climate change is probably the most difficult problem that humanity has ever faced, and it really just begins with our biological constitution. Carbon dioxide is a substance that we don't taste, we don't see it, we don't smell it, we don't immediately experience its effects. If it were the case that carbon dioxide, you know, stunk to high heaven, if it were a sickly yellow color, there's no doubt that we would already be controlling it in some way. So climate change is just, in the first instance, the kind of problem that doesn't set off sensory alarm bells in us. And so we're not very good at responding to problems that don't just confront us with immediate crises. But the other big piece of this is that carbon is the lifeblood of the global economy. And so the issue doesn't have the kind of immediate us versus them dynamic that many other issues do. So just take an issue like inequality, for example, the sort of issue that set off Occupy movements around the world and is featured in Thomas Piketty's book. The inequality has now become so great in the United States and in some other developed countries that it's very easy to divide class lines. I mean, even people who didn't like talking class politics 10 years ago or 5 years ago have almost got to resort to class politics now because the inequality is so great and the worlds that are inhabited by different social classes are so radically distinct. But that's mostly not true when it comes to climate change. We all benefit from the emissions of greenhouse gases. We all are responsible for emissions in some way. We all economically benefit from it. Now, there are some people in some parts of the world that don't, and there are certainly people who benefit more and those who benefit less. But when you talk to the average American, for example, about this problem with emitting carbon, it's very easy for people to get confused and say, but how am I supposed to go shopping? How do I take the kids to school? I mean, what am I supposed to do with my life? There's a sense of powerlessness that often attaches to this issue that I think makes it very difficult to mobilize action.
Do you think there's also something about the immensity of the problem that is hard for people to come to terms with?
Yeah, and I have to say, to some extent, I think that's there's been a kind of conscious strategy that also has sort of piggybacked on the ways that we naturally think about this problem. So the denial strategy, in part, is about denying the existence of the problem until it's too late to do anything about it. So there's a kind of polarity that works for people who don't want to act on this problem, which is to deny, 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 and then say, we can't do anything about it. It's now a fait accompli. And I think it's been a very successful strategy in many ways. And it is a very difficult issue for me to address in my book because on the one hand, I think we need to be honest and say, we have committed the world to 1,000 years of climate change. That's a fact. We have to accept it. There's no preventing climate change. But that doesn't mean that there's nothing we can do. It matters that we slow it down and limit its extent, and it matters how we adapt to it. So there's still things we can do, even though we've lost the fundamental struggle.
Against the Grain is the program. My name is Sasha Lilly, and I'm speaking with Dale Jamieson. He is the author of Reason in a Dark Time, Why the Struggle Against Climate Change Failed, and What It Means for Our Future. He teaches at NYU. One of the things that I think has influenced some people's perspective about climate change in terms of a kind of overwhelming pessimism has to do with a notion of tipping points, that there are these thresholds that get crossed, and after that, there are processes set in motion that can't be reversed. Where does this notion of tipping points come from, and how backed up by science is it, and is it useful?
So it's interesting because we do know that there are tipping points. There are tipping points in nature. There are tipping points in social life. But if you just do a sort of Google search on the term tipping points, what you discover is that a whole lot of them seem to come into existence after the publication of Malcolm Gladwell's book, Tipping Points. It's something that we became very aware of as a society and as a culture at a particular datable point in time. Now, when it comes to the climate system, there's no doubt that, as with other complex systems, there are tipping points. It's just that we don't really know exactly where they are and exactly how they function. And I actually think that the rhetoric of tipping point is often not been a very useful rhetoric in the way that we think about climate change. Part of the problem with the tipping point rhetoric is it becomes, again, this all-or-nothing thing. As long as we don't cross some tipping point or cross some line, then everything is okay. If we cross the line, then everything is lost. Now, there probably are those tipping points, though we don't know where they are. But more importantly, it's better to have less emissions than more emissions, both because it will reduce our chances of reaching a tipping point, but also because it'll make the change more manageable. So, you know, I would rather see us just focus on the hard slog that is this problem rather than focus on the kind of catastrophic scenarios.
Well, I know your book is not written as a prescriptive book, essentially, but you do actually talk about things that can be done or you think should be done. So I want to turn to that and ask you about them and how you see the tension between trying to find ways to adapt and find ways to mitigate the effects of global warming.
Right. So I think the first thing that should be mentioned is that there are some things that are ways of adapting to global warming that also have a mitigation effect as well. So, for example, planting trees can be a way of helping you adapt to a warmer world, and it can also provide carbon storage. So when it comes to kind of policy decisions about what communities can do and so on, in a lot of cases we can use this piggyback strategy and don't really have to choose between mitigation and adaptation. I guess my major concerns in these areas are really twofold. One is on the adaptation side. I don't have any doubt that countries like the United States will do a pretty good job of adapting to climate change because essentially we're rich. I live in New York. I lived through Hurricane Sandy. People were sufficiently freaked out by Hurricane Sandy that New York will do a decent job of adapting to rising sea waters. It will be clumsy, it will be expensive, it won't be an optimal strategy, but there will be a strategy. But what's going to happen in Bangladesh, what's going to happen in Mumbai, what's going to happen in Alexandria, that's another matter. So there is, in the background of this issue, always this concern of global justice, where the people and the nations and the corporations that have done most of the emitting are not going to bear most of the costs, at least not without a really concerned citizens' movement to try to make sure that they do. The other side of this issue, which is one that I think people don't talk very much about, is a deeply personal side, which is the world that we're going to be living in, and increasingly are living in, is a very different world than the world that we've inherited. And that's going to affect the stories that we tell our children. It's going to affect the way that we read novels. It's going to affect the way that we experience nature in the future. And we're going to have to find new ways of finding meaning in a world that is increasingly under human control and domination, where even the weather is now something that is in some sense made by people rather than given to us by nature. And I think we need to think on both of those tracks at the same time, because if we don't think about what this means for our lives as individuals, then we aren't going to feel the sense of agency and empowerment in the world that will actually help us to be able to make change at a political level.
Well, what do you mean by that more specifically? I mean, on the one hand, there has been a lot of rhetoric about individual action, individual consumption, which I think quite a few people have felt very uneasy about, because really it just makes a tiny dent in a huge problem. It sounds like you're talking about something perhaps a little different, but could you explain what you mean?
So, yes, I don't mean that individual action is going to solve this problem. I mean that at the end of the day, at the place where our politics ends is still a place where in some way we have to live our lives. There's still places that we need to go to find solace and to find meaning in our lives that are even beyond political action. And many of those sources are not going to be available, or at least they're going to look really different in the kind of world that we're creating. So let me just give you an example. I mentioned earlier that I'm working on a book with a novelist now called Love in the Anthropocene. And we're interested in what it will mean to love nature, for example, in a world in which nature is now something directly under human control, where, in the past, we've seen we're now in a sixth wave of species extinction, but we are spending huge amounts of money to try to protect species in reserves and some cases in zoos and so on. But much of those attempts to preserve nature and natural places, even places in your backyard, even, say, the local ecology of the Bay Area, are simply going to be swept away by climate change. There's no holding it back, just like there's no holding back the seawater. And what it means for you to take your children or your grandchildren or your friends to Point Reyes, for example, is going to mean something very different from what it was for you to have experiences in those places. And so we're going to have to try to understand and interpret what it's going to be like to live in a radically transformed and radically humanized world. That's not a substitute for politics. That's not a way of doing politics. That's another thing that we do with our lives in addition to doing political action.
And that's food for thought, and I'm afraid we have to end it there. Thank you so much, Dale Jameson, for joining me.
Thank you, Sasha.
I've been speaking with the author of Reason in a Dark Time, Why the Struggle Against Climate Change Failed and What It Means for Our Future. You can find a link to that book on our website, Against the Grain. The book is published by Oxford University Press. Dale Jameson teaches environmental studies, philosophy, and law at New York University and is formerly affiliated with the National Center for Atmospheric Research. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for joining us. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.F. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.